Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, Kristen Espeland has a report on ethanol production in Kentucky and how it affects food prices. First, horse racing has been in the spotlight the last few weeks as hopes for a Triple Crown winner began to build. Those inside the industry have seen it as a good chance to win over new fans. But as Stephanie Sanders reports, a dispute between horsemen, the people who own and train the thoroughbreds, and track owners may alienate some of the sport's fan base.
Remember when we couldn't watch new episodes of Grey's Anatomy and The Daily Show suddenly got a lot less funny? The Hollywood writer's strike was all about getting a bigger piece of the internet distribution pie. It's the same growing pain being felt by companies that sell or show their wares on the internet, and Kentucky's signature industry is no exception. In fact, it may be the last hope for the horse industry.
The one area that's growing in market share is the online wagering business.
Churchill Downs Incorporated is one of the groups involved in the dispute. Senior Vice President Kevin Flannery says the company got into the online betting business early last year when it launched its own advanced deposit wagering, or ADW, company called TwinSpires.com at a cost of $100 million. It differs from other forms of betting in that participants must pre-deposit money into an account and then use an online ADW company to place the bet. It's growing in popularity for the same reasons iTunes has: convenience and interactivity.
The online business is not just a good thing for Churchill Downs, it's a necessity for the business.
The problem is that horsemen say they aren't getting their fair share. They're trying to learn from mistakes made during the off-track betting boom. Betting was originally only available at the racetrack and only on races at that track. When off-track betting was introduced, tracks and horsemen negotiated a smaller percentage of betting revenue for themselves because they assumed those bets would be new money, but it wasn't. Betting just shifted from on-track to off-track sites where simulcasting was available. Martin Maline of the Kentucky Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association says they have to get it right this time.
We just feel that, look, we can't do another situation like we did with simulcasting. We need a larger share of that revenue.
So they asked Churchill Downs for a bigger cut of the internet betting revenue and were rejected. They then pulled permission to have races at Churchill Downs simulcast on advanced deposit wagering websites, which is their right under federal law. Shortly after that, Churchill Downs cut purses by 20%. The horsemen contend it was a retaliatory move, but Churchill Downs claims it's pure economics. Churchill Downs' Kevin Flannery says if the requests of the horsemen were met, TwinSpires.com wouldn't be able to make money.
We can't get into a position where two businesses that are losing money are taking money from one another, because ultimately that's a recipe for failure.
Federal antitrust laws prohibit Flannery from disclosing the exact amounts or even percentages horsemen, the track, and the ADW company split in betting revenue. While the two sides continue negotiations, they may be losing their customer base.
Right now, there are no winners.
Ed DeRosa is the news editor at the Thoroughbred Times.
The fans are the ones who feel most shut out by this, and I think long term that is going to affect both parties more than either one is affecting each other right now.
As the dispute enters its third month, Churchill races are still blacked out on advanced deposit wagering sites, online betting is down, and as a result, purses are down, which means fewer horsemen are entering their horses in races at the Downs. And DeRosa says it could go on much longer.
Churchill's going to ride this out. I think the horsemen have to play its hand before Churchill does.
New York horsemen so far aren't engaged in this dispute, so betting on yesterday's Belmont Stakes took place on track, off track, and online. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
Ethanol production is booming in Kentucky, but as Kristen Espeland reports, the jury's still out on this alternative fuel's costs and benefits.
First, some benefits. Ethanol is a kind of biofuel made most often from corn. It's added to gasoline to increase the oxygen content, and that makes the gas burn more efficiently and cleaner. About half of America's gasoline gets blended with 10% ethanol. The American Ethanol Coalition reports that blend reduces greenhouse gases by up to 20%. Also, new ethanol plants provide jobs as well as a market for farmers. Plus, it's politically popular. The president wants ethanol to make up a significant part of the nation's energy portfolio. Now, here are some costs.
A spike in worldwide demand for corn used in livestock feed, food products, and ethanol production is straining supplies.
You can't turn on the TV or open the paper today without food supplies or prices in the headlines. But the cause of what many are calling this food crisis is still unclear. Some blame the rising price of corn for higher grocery bills, corn being a staple ingredient of so many foods, and some blame ethanol, which uses corn that might have otherwise entered the food supply. Here's how Adam Andrews from the Kentucky Corn Growers Association explains it. Not surprisingly, he says corn is the scapegoat. Forces other than corn are at work when it comes to food prices.
The U.S. economy is starting to enter a recession. That's causing a lot of hedge funds, speculation that's being shifted from stock markets over into the commodities futures market and grains market.
It's certainly true the commodities markets are flourishing. Betting on corn right now makes a lot of sense. Corn prices keep rising, and corn is in more demand. For example, a fifth of the nation's corn went into making ethanol, and the price of a ton of corn has more than doubled in the last 4 years. Ethanol production itself has more than doubled since then in this country, and in Kentucky, the amount of ethanol produced is expected to grow from about 38 million gallons a year right now to nearly 185 million gallons by 2009. But again, is ethanol to blame for those high food prices?
Clearly, biofuels must have some impact because they are competing for agricultural output.
This is Liz Marshall. She's an economist and biofuels expert with the World Resources Institute.
But the extent of that impact relative to other drivers of food prices, like increased demand and the increased price of energy, it's very difficult to know.
Federal and international agencies disagree about the exact link between ethanol and high food prices. Agencies from the World Bank to the USDA have devoted hundreds of pages of research to that question. What gives?
It's very difficult to sort through it all, and part of that is because, of course, every group has its own agenda, and part of it just is that we simply don't have the analytical capacity to understand it at this point, to understand all of the forces that are at work.
Forces like the price of oil, the price of other commodities, a late corn planting, and even drought. But questions about ethanol go beyond its significance for food prices. Proponents say it will help liberate us from imported oil and that it will reduce greenhouse gases. Critics say other environmental problems outweigh those benefits, problems like more agricultural runoff from corn production. But ethanol fans and detractors alike say we're not locked into corn. All you really need to make ethanol is sugar, and that can come from the sugars in leftovers like corn stalks. And it can also come from your favorite fizzy beverage. A company headquartered in Louisville is making ethanol, more than 3 million gallons a year of it, from unwanted consumer products, beer, wine, soda pop, anything that contains sugar. Parallel Products spokesman Hal Park took me to the plant's warehouse.
These products are coming off the market for whatever reason. Maybe there's a bad packaging. Maybe the product's been discontinued.
The place looks like a Sam's Club or a liquor barn. Workers load these boxes, packaging and all, onto a conveyor belt. Then everything drops into a cage-like metal mouth.
The cage spins the product around. The glass breaks up. The cardboard falls apart, the liquid drains down.
And everything is captured. The liquid gets sent to fermentation tanks, cooked and distilled and turned into ethanol. And all of the packaging is recycled. It's a promising technology for fuel that doesn't require new land to be cleared for corn or corn to be diverted from the food market to the fuel market. But not many people are making it this way. That's because the process is just a bit more complicated. For now, corn-based ethanol production seems set to grow. Strong incentives, from state to federal subsidies and tax credits, make producing ethanol attractive in Kentucky and across the nation. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Last week, the Muhammad Ali Center Board of Directors approved the appointment of Greg Roberts to be the center's new president and CEO. Roberts, a Washington, D.C. native, has been a longtime advocate of underserved youth and will be the Ali Center's second president. He succeeds Mike Fox, who stepped down last year. I spoke with Greg Roberts about his background and his vision for the Ali Center. What attracted you to this job?
You know, the interesting thing about my whole journey and my career was that I had worked for one that I thought was the most amazing athletes and humanitarians in Magic Johnson. And when this opportunity came before, Muhammad Ali had also been one of those individuals that I had admired from afar. And so to have this opportunity in a career to work for two people who I admired, it's just been a fantastic opportunity for me.
I would assume part of the interview process was meeting Lonnie and Muhammad Ali. How was that for you?
That was great. But, you know, actually I met both of them before. I met both of them at an Urban League dinner in New York back in 98, where both Magic and Mr. Ali were being honored. So I spent about 2 hours in a hotel room with he and Lonnie. So I actually had the opportunity to meet him earlier.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you'll be doing at the Ali Center.
You know, the Ali Center is based on Mr. Ali's six principles. And so my plan is to really make the Ali Center as a must sort of go place for the, obviously for the community of Louisville and surrounding areas, but on the national and international level. I think that it's really a big secret. Even myself, who's traveled, you know, significantly, did come by the center back in 2006, realized that, you know, a lot of people don't know about the center. And so we plan to sort of beat the brushes around letting people know what the center is about, having, you know, inviting guests in nationally, internationally, and also being opening it up to young people, especially around those principles, and also to have parents and teachers become part of the center. We'll be doing some training and some opportunities that we hope to open up. So I really plan to make it a very interactive experience for the community and for individuals. So we look forward to that. And I want to highlight, you know, the wonderful, you know, I've been to a lot of places. I've visited the Clinton Library. I've visited a number of cultural arts and museums around the country. And I think this by far is one of the best architectural facilities I've ever seen, as well as it being tremendously interactive, which is something that's really new, that young people can touch and feel things where, you know, most places you go it's off limits to do that. So I'm looking forward to that, and also just introducing myself to the Louisville community and being a part of that community. I'm out here in D.C. I'm on several boards and I'm very active in the community, so I look forward to extending my volunteer efforts in the city as well.
What are you doing these days? You mentioned the Magic Johnson organization. Are you still involved with that?
I'm still very close with their organization. You know, presently I've been here in D.C. for 7 years leading the D.C. Children Youth Investment Trust Corporation. We've been able to support, we've raised about $150 million and on an annual basis support about 19,000 children here in the District of Columbia. So those are, I'm very proud of that accomplishment as well. I came on an organization when it was very new, only had 5 people at the organization. Today we have over 50 that work for us.
When are you moving to town?
I'm trying to get that together now. You know, those are always difficult things to do, but I've come to Louisville several times to meet with the board and other individuals, and I've had a great admiration for Mayor Abramson. I've known and heard of his work with children for a number of years. So I'm just, you know, I'm looking forward to coming. I should be there sometime in July. And also, I think it's a wonderful city. And one of the more amazing things about it is I've been in these heavily congested cities, you know, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, and just to have, not to see a lot of congestion is going to be a joy for me on a personal side, not to have to take an hour and a half to get to work, and I only live 5 miles from the office. So I think I'm looking forward to that especially.
You can get from point A to point B here in a reasonable amount of time.
I mean, you just don't know. I mean, you know, with $4 gas and the stress that it comes with commuting, I plan to live downtown and take full advantage of the new development in the arts community that's downtown. So I'm really looking forward to that opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations on the new job, and we look forward to meeting you in July.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Greg Roberts, the new president and CEO of the Muhammad Ali Center. A new report claims Kentucky's Medicaid office isn't doing enough to communicate with families of children who are insured under that plan. We'll talk with the report's author when we come back. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer has a report on art bikes in Louisville. First, an agency called Kentucky Youth Advocates released a report last week called In the Dark, Families Share Their Experiences with Kentucky Health Choices. It claims the Medicaid program for Kentucky's children isn't doing enough to educate families about its plans. Stephanie Sanders spoke with the report's author, Makita Harris.
We've learned that initially a lot of the changes that occurred when Kentucky's Medicaid program became KY Health Choices in terms of limiting benefit services and increasing cost sharing to its beneficiaries were more impacted, had a bigger impact with the adults enrolled in the program. In terms of children specifically, cost sharing did not significantly change, and service limits did not significantly change. But the important thing to address in terms of the impact that it has made on children is the fact that some of the changes that were made in terms of soft limits have been very confusing to parents and as well as medical providers. And it seems as though significant information gaps has really what has exacerbated access to health care. So with the changes happening in the program and significant information gaps, it has shown, based on the focus groups that we conducted with families, to have some impact on children's ability to access some health care services. So we've basically learned that communication, especially now, is very important in terms of families understanding their benefits, understanding the process by which prior authorizations are conducted, and so forth.
Can you give me some examples of that playing out in the lives of Kentucky families?
Sure. Well, when we, you know, policy makers and people such as myself, health advocates, refer to Medicaid's, Kentucky's Medicaid program as KY Health Choices, like I said. Whereas when you talk to families, they just know that, you know, they refer to them as just having a medical card. They don't seem to have a lot of understanding or information in terms of the type of health insurance coverage that they have. Many don't have an understanding of whether it's what plan under KY Health Choices their children are enrolled in. There's four plans under KY Health Choices. Most children are enrolled in Family Choices. So there's just a disconnect in terms of some of the basic understandings that families have in terms of their children's health care coverage.
And then I would imagine if the communication isn't there on those very basic initial steps, then that has consequences for other things, for maybe when a child has a health care need.
Yeah, it certainly does. And also, it's important that the medical community have the information that they need also in terms of, you know, improving, helping their ability to provide that care. We found in our report that some of the changes in terms of prescription drugs that were implemented under KY Health Choices was inadvertently affecting children in the program. Adults now are limited to only four name brand prescription drugs of four name brand prescription drugs per month, and we ran into some families whose children was experiencing difficulties getting prescription drugs because there was a misunderstanding that that limit applied to children as well, when it actually doesn't. So closing the information gaps is very important. And even though the state sends out letters to families and to the medical community, it seems as though it's really important for families to, it's important for the letters to be easy to read. It's important that the families understand what's in the letters. And it's also important for families to be able to contact someone if they have questions about what's in the information sent to them or regarding their children's health care coverage.
Is that not happening right now?
Well, we did find that there are problems in terms of the toll-free customer service line that is provided to families. And there's also, we received an overwhelming response from focus group participants in terms of their experiences at the local DCBS offices, Department for Community-Based Services offices, who administer the Medicaid and K-CHIP. There seems to be, to some extent, and poor customer service, where phone calls are often unreturned. You call the customer service number, and you're on hold for long periods of time. And the customer service number is not always able to help you with specific questions regarding your child's benefit coverage or loss of a card, very basic things that I think people who are enrolled in private health insurance probably take for granted, that some of these families didn't seem to be getting answers to in a timely manner.
So what steps need to be taken to fix these problems, and I guess who needs to take those steps?
Well, you know, I guess the first thing that we suggest is for the state Medicaid office to really evaluate their communication plan with families and medical providers to make sure that the information is being sent out regularly, to make sure the information is understandable for both groups, and to also engage community-based practices when trying to communicate with families. A lot of families that we talk to get most of their information from access points such as schools and clinics and other community groups. So it seems the more effective communication could be done through these community groups and community-based settings where families depend on getting most of their information from, and also in many cases depend on getting assistance in terms of navigating the health system.
Makita Harris, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That was Stephanie Sanders speaking with Makita Harris of Kentucky Youth Advocates. Representatives from Kentucky's Medicaid office say the report is flawed because it's just a snapshot of a few families who are served by the program. You can learn more at our website, WFPL.org. Higher gas prices have people considering other forms of transportation, and some of them are riding to express themselves. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
At the Clarksville Schwinn and Fitness bike shop in Indiana, soaring gas prices mean booming business, says store owner Bob Peters.
Everybody's bringing their bikes in, getting them fixed, talking about riding to the store, talking about riding back and forth to work.
Business here is up 22% from this time last year, and the increase has led Peters to hire three more full-time employees. He says the demand for bikes and parts is exceeding supply, leading to delays of orders. Across the river, some people are making their own bikes and decking them out to express themselves. In old Louisville's Brick House Community Center, Seed Meller Weller Morloki is looking through a back room where bike parts are everywhere. Morloki is here to help visitors fix and assemble bikes. He has built five bikes and had another 15 in various stages of construction when his home, an artist haven called the Lava House, burned down in January. Some were tricked out with different parts to make them taller or longer. He calls them self-expression on wheels and says anyone can personalize a bike.
It becomes an extension of yourself and you can just do whatever you want to it. There's people with pearl-covered baskets, and there's people with raccoon tails on their bikes. Some people put like some horns on there. Any colors, any paint you want, it's just really easy just to make it art itself.
Last summer, a group of his friends and friends of friends, many with their own self-styled bikes, regularly rode through the city. Morloki was part of it.
So we put on some crazy costumes, and then we go throughout the city grabbing as many people as we can, and then we started having regular meetings to ride.
This group calls themselves the Louisville Bike Goblins. They weren't on critical mass rides where bikers take over the streets and often block traffic. Last year, they often rode to destinations for a purpose. They volunteered for several river cleanup projects. Most bike goblins share the same values. They shun commercialism for artistic self-expression. They talk about self-reliance and building cleaner and more supportive communities. Morlocki says there were few negative reactions from those who saw the group on rides.
Most people just smiled, like the circus just went by.
While the Louisville Bike Goblins is not a highly structured group, others with similar values have established themselves in other American cities. Some even have written philosophies and manifestos. There's Chunk 666 in Portland, Oregon, and the Rat Patrol in Chicago.
Part of the gestalt of the Rat Patrol is this notion of genuine autonomy, and so they build their own bikes. They don't want you buying bikes and sort of entering into that consumerist culture that they don't like.
That's Harry Ray, a professor of political science at Chicago's DePaul University and author of Pedal Power, The Quiet Rise of the Bicycle in American Public Life. He's ridden with the Rat Patrol, whose members make homemade bikes of all shapes, sizes, and colors. It also calls itself an anarchist organization, but he says it isn't so menacing on the streets.
Whenever the Rat Patrol cruises around the city, it always evokes a sense of wonder in people. They love seeing them.
The popularity of stylized bikes has crossed over into the art and commercial worlds. Last month's Bicycle Film Festival in New York City included an art exhibit of bikes at a downtown gallery. At last year's Art Basel Miami Beach, an adorned bicycle sold for $35,000. And the fashion house Chanel has produced a limited edition bicycle that sells for a cool $12,000. Riding around downtown Louisville, Thalen Hubble looks artful on the bike he made himself, with its black frame and bright yellow and pink wheels. This bike courier has had several jobs working with bikes, but he wants to use his experience to launch a creative endeavor.
I've decided that I think I like fabrication best, and I hope to have a career in building bicycles, perhaps even here in Louisville. I'm hoping to have a company started at the beginning of next year.
Hubble's plans might not mesh with the ethos of Chicago's Rat Patrol, but they do illustrate a common phenomenon, that underground movements evolve into pop culture and are seized for commercial interests. But does the commercialization of tricked-out bikes trump art? Not if you agree with Andy Warhol, who said, being good in business is the most fascinating kind of art. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are.
One of the most talked about issues with the recent budget cuts in Louisville has been the decision to keep 5 public swimming pools closed this summer. In reaction to that, residents of the Phoenix Hill and surrounding neighborhoods formed the Save Urban Pools Coalition. Their goal is to reopen 2 of the pools at Breslin and Shelby Parks. Gabe Bullard sat down with one of the group's leaders, Cindy Brown Kinlock, to talk about their efforts.
What are your main objections towards the pools closing?
The 2 pools that we are particularly fighting for, Shelby Park Pool and Breslin Pool, the children and kids and families that use those pools are families that can't afford to go other places. They can't afford memberships at other pools. They don't have cars that they can always hop into and get to other pools. They're families that may not have air conditioning and need a place to cool off. They're children that whose parents, for whatever reason, may not be able to supervise them well or provide them with summer activities during the summer, and they're kids that need healthy activities and places to go to be supervised as well.
Number-wise, the pool attendance was pretty low, though, right?
Yes. Well, the pools have different. Actually, Breslin Pool had the highest attendance, I think, of the pools that they were actually closing down. Our feeling on attendance, if you've gone to look at the pools at all, I spent the last 2 summers at Breslin Pool with my children, and my mother-in-law couldn't come and watch the kids swim because there was no place to sit, not a single chair. There was one table for the lifeguards to sit at on their break. There were no chairs. There was not a stitch of shade anywhere. There's not even a sign out front that says public pool welcome, anything that would let you know that it's a pool that you can attend. People that have seen the front of the building, it's not very inviting. And we think that there are a lot of things that could be done to raise the attendance by getting chairs and tables, by putting shade or shade structures in, by making it a more inviting place, by upgrading the playground. The playground that's there next to the pool is, I think, the third oldest in the city and is paint peeling everywhere and just looks really bad. There's nothing inviting about the park. We also, the neighborhood association surrounding, the Phoenix Hill Neighborhood Association, Irish Hill Neighborhood Association, Butchertown Neighborhood Association, the Clifton Area Council, all want the pool to be open and are willing to do neighborhood events and do what we can to help raise the attendance. So we feel strongly that the attendance thing would not be an issue if the pool was given some attention.
Was there a push at all before you heard that the pool is closing to spruce up the facilities?
No, for a couple reasons. One is we really didn't know that attendance was a problem at all, because most people that you talk to that drive past Breslin Pool, and I'm talking mainly about Breslin because that's the pool I'm most familiar with, anybody driving past there would say, every time I drove past there seemed to be a lot of kids there. So we did not realize that attendance was an issue. And most neighborhoods in that area have ongoing battles that keep coming up that we're having to deal with. So it wasn't something that was in the forefront. I would say that if Metro Parks or the mayor had come to us and said, attendance is a problem, we're going to need to close these pools soon because they're not paying for themselves. We need your help. I think the neighborhood associations would have stepped up immediately and said, yes, we want to keep this pool, and yes, we will do what we can to do that.
What are your plans for the money that you've raised so far? You've raised over $35,000 to
yes,
keep the pools open?
Yes, over $35,000, and there's still some continuing fundraising going on with businesses. We were kind of waiting to see what the city's response was. What we would like to do with the money is to use the money to make the upgrades that need to happen that we think will make it a more inviting place to be, and then that the city would continue to operate the pools. We would be willing to use the money to match the city's money to help open the pools and then try to find other money and other volunteers and other grants to help do the upgrades.
Do you have numbers on how much the repairs to the pool would be?
For Breslin Pool, to operate for the summer is $85,000. The cost for capital expenses to bring it up to be used is about $25,000. So the total for that pool is $110,000. For Shelby Park, they quoted the operating expenses at $105,000 and the capital expenses to bring it up to be able to be opened about $34,000. So the total for that is $139,000. And those are figures that Metro Parks gave us.
So have you heard that the city might put in any extra money or that you might raise that $110,000?
Yeah. We are hearing from the mayor and from Metro Parks that they are not going to open the pools. We went to the budget meeting with the Metro Council, the public hearing the other day, and felt like they were much more responsive to all of the emails that they're getting and for the community outcry. I mean, Kelly Downard said at the meeting, we haven't had this sort of public outcry for anything from what I can remember.
Even though there is the outcry, Councilwoman Judy Green brought up at the meeting, she said, well, there's other things that we need to pay for. There's homelessness programs, there's senior citizen care programs that also need money. So what's your response to that?
I agree. I think there's a lot of needs out there. I don't agree with the cuts in social services and human services that they've done. I do think that the pool is a public safety issue. It's not just an entertainment. It's an issue of health equity for families that can't afford other options. It's an issue of taking care of our vulnerable children. It's an issue of, again, exercise, childhood obesity is going up. It's all of these things. It's an issue of creating stronger neighborhoods in the urban area. When you put a homeless, hungry child up against swimming, it doesn't seem, like swimming would, would match up. But I do think it's a public safety issue. It's not like playing softball, riding a bike. It's a life-saving skill that all of our children need to know. We are a river city, and all of our children need to know how to swim, and a lot of children don't have the option, and these options are being taken away. And as was brought up also at that public hearing, the city is using money to help buy property in downtown to do another type of project like 4th Street Live, and that's going to be a $17.6 million bond issue, and the debt service on that would be $750,000 a year, something like that. And we think that that money could be better used to provide the human and social services for the agencies that have been cut, as well as to help provide pools for the kids that need them.
When the final budget is passed, if there's not money in it for the pools, what will you do then?
We are continuing to look for public-private partnerships for nonprofits that may be interested. There's a national nonprofit, USA Swim, that has shown interest in these pools. You know, part of what we're asking from the city is to help keep the pools open while we can look for long-term solutions that could involve public-private partnerships.
It seems like with this $35,000, in the meantime, you could, even with the attendance numbers, buy a pool membership at another pool for all the kids and set up some sort of like carpooling program. Have you given that any thought?
We have talked about that, again, hoping to look for a longer-term solution and hoping to use that money for something that's a little longer-term. At some point, we may make the decision to do that. But again, right now, we're looking at trying to use that money for a long-term solution.
That was Gabe Buller talking with Cindy Brown Kinlock, who's part of the coalition trying to reopen the Breslin and Shelby Park pools. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The Juneteenth Legacy Theater's annual jamboree of new plays opened this weekend with a slate of work. There's a selection of scenes and monologues from the plays of August Wilson and new plays, including one called Bringing Back Josephine. Ron Himes is the founder and producing director of St. Louis Black Rep, and he's the guest artist in several performances in this year's jamboree. He spoke with Elizabeth Kramer about his work here with Louisville's only African-American theater company.
What do you feel that putting this montage together, what can it reveal to people about August Wilson that they might not get from just seeing one play on its own?
I think that it's a great, great sampling of all 10 plays. The excerpts, I think, are pretty in-depth. I think that Lorna has done a great job with the scenes that she's chosen, with the cuts that she's made to sort of put the scenes together to give them sort of some continuity and a really strong dramatic arc. I think the monologues are really, really strong in terms of how they support the scenes that follow the monologues, or actually the scenes that lead into the monologues. And it's been really great working with a really talented group of local actors here in the plays. So far, I've done scenes with Linda Kennedy, who's from the company in St. Louis, but most of the rest of the actors are local, and they've been really, really great to work with.
Then moving on to Bringing Back Josephine.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first see the play see the script? And how has that been going in developing, and what does it communicate?
I saw the script a couple of weeks ago, and I got it and had an opportunity to take a quick read of it, and actually got it while I was directing the final show of our season in St. Louis. And so I really had a second thorough read of it once I got here to Louisville. And the rehearsals have been going really, really well. It is another play that deals with family. It's sort of light, much lighter than all of the August Wilson plays. And it deals with creative expression and how in the African-American community, and I'm sure it's in other communities as well, but I know of it in the African-American community where there's a generational sort of divide where a member of the family who has creative yearnings or creative talent is not really supported or encouraged to pursue those creative yearnings because they are not seen as being practical in terms of a career, in terms of stability, in terms of a way to earn a living. And it's really, really interesting to me because even in my case, I remember for years, even after I had started the company in St. Louis and we had been in business 10, 15 years, my older sisters and brothers still kept asking me, when are you going to get a real job? Mm-hmm. And so the play deals with a teenage girl in this family who is gifted as a young dancer, who wants a career as a dancer, and her mother strongly discourages her from even thinking about applying for a scholarship to which she would get because she's really, really talented and she has good grades. But her mother discourages her from pursuing that road because she doesn't think that there's a future in it.
Is there a certain African-American perspective in the play that is different from other communities? You kind of touched on that a little
right.
bit.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I also teach at Washington University. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my students, African-American and others as well, you know, will talk to me about, you know, they want to major in theater, but they're really majoring in biology and they're minoring in theater, or they're majoring in history or English and minoring in theater because their parents won't let them major in theater.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a personal experience because you majored in business, correct?
Right. my degree was in business administration from Washington University. But my story is kind of different in that in high school and in college, I didn't really have much, if any, interest in the theater. I didn't really get interested in theater until I was a second semester junior in college. And that semester, a couple of friends of mine dared me to audition for a play. I took the dare, auditioned for the play, got cast in the play in one of the major roles, was pretty good, had fun. And when I graduated with my degree in business, my options were become an accountant, stay in school and get an MBA degree, or try that theater stuff. And I started doing theater then because I didn't want to be an accountant.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about the presence of something like the Juneteenth Theater Festival here and real African-American theater presence here? And what is the state of African-American theater these days, you know, in the United States, especially, you know, outside the big city venues?
Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty dire times for African-American theaters across the country, even in the major markets, even in large cities. There are lots of large cities that don't have major African-American theater companies anymore. The economy is really, really taking, its toll on everything. And, of course, the arts are suffering tremendously. And African-American arts institutions are really, really taking a big, big hit in terms of corporate funding, in terms of individual giving, in terms of people just coming out buying tickets. So it's really a struggle to continue to produce work. It's a struggle to develop new work, particularly, and it's really, really risky to try to do new work. So the fact that Juneteenth Legacy Theater could have this kind of presence and this kind of support here in Louisville, I think, is just great. I think it's a testament to the community's support of a venture like this because, if there were no Juneteenth Legacy Theater here, would this community be exposed to all 10 of August Wilson's plays? The answer is probably no. Would local African-American playwrights have a venue to have their work developed and showcased? The answer is probably no. Would young African-American actors and students from the universities here who are interested in a career in the theater have an opportunity to work at this festival with professionals and with playwrights working on new plays, have that opportunity? The answer is probably no. So I think that the fact that the festival is here and the breadth of the work and offerings that the festival has is just tremendous.
What would you say to people if they say, you know, well, we have theater, why do we need African-American theater?
I think the reason that we need it is because we have theater. Yes. We have probably, I don't know how many companies in Louisville, but what the American theater attempts to do is to tell American stories. What is so often missing from those stories are African-American perspectives, African-American history, African-American stories. And what an African-American theater company does is to help a community realize the entire American history. It gives it an opportunity to see stories from more than one perspective. And it gives us all an opportunity to share and to make the fabric of our communities richer.
Well, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.